Disruption Zone. Opportunity lives where the status quo dies. Talking to the greatest innovators, disruptors, and off-the-wall inventors we can scrounge up. You laugh, you'll learn, you'll be inspired. Now, here are your hosts, Leland Conway and Cameron Mills.
You know, there's a lot of talk about what is going on in the Middle East. And one of the things that I've always talked about on my show is how important context is to everything. And, you know, I hear a lot of people that are pundits simply say, well, you know, the folks in the Middle East have been killing each other forever and so on and so forth. And I think that's an easy way to write off a complicated situation. I wanted to bring on to the Disruption Zone an author of an incredible new book called Black Wave: Saudi Arabia, Iran, and the 40-year rivalry that unraveled culture, religion, and the collective memory in the Middle East. It's Kim Gaddis, and she is terrific. And welcome to the Disruption Zone, Kim. How are you?
Thanks so much, Lynn, for having me. It's great to be on the show.
For background, you were raised, I mean, you're from Lebanon, is that right? Did I read that correctly?
That is correct. And, born and raised in Beirut.
Okay. And you live part-time in the United States and part-time in Beirut now. And you have a passion for, I guess, what is happening in the Middle East in terms of the violence and how complicated an issue it is. Give me a little background on your book, Black Wave, and what you're wanting to achieve here.
Yeah, well, I have a passion, you're right, for the Middle East, for the region that I come from, where I grew up. And I have a passion for storytelling. So if you combine those two, you end up with Black Wave, which is a narrative-driven book about the Middle East and its history over the last 40 years. I like to describe it as the 1001 Nights of Modern Middle Eastern Geopolitics, because I take the geopolitics and I boil it down into a book that is a story about people. It's important to reconnect with the people of the region and go beyond all the headlines about violence, about terrorists and tyrants. So it's 40 years of history, seven countries from Iran to Pakistan to Egypt and my own country of Lebanon, and 15 incredible characters, real people whose lives have been upended by the politics and the geopolitics. And by telling their story, I'm able to get to the bigger picture of the geopolitics and why the Saudi-Iran rivalry is still of such huge consequence, not only to the region's security, but really the world's security and America's security when you think of prices of oil or U.S. Troops perhaps being sent back to the Middle East. But I wanted to write this book for two key reasons. I wanted to answer a question of what happened to us in the region, because as you mentioned, Leland, it hasn't been that long that the region's been like that. And it's true that very often American officials and American politicians say, oh, well, it's always been like that. It's always going to be like this. And so, you know, why even bother? But that's not correct. It's only been 40 years that we're really in the throes of such violence and upheaval. And it's important to remember that, because it means that we can return to a more positive and progressive future, because our not-so-distant past was like that. And I wanted to answer that question also for us in the region and for readers in the U.S.
You mentioned, like for instance, that region. If you study back and you go back through history, so much of modern culture, even Western culture, can track itself back to the culture of the Middle East, you know, advancements in science and math. But beyond that, even if you look at the Iran of, say, the 1960s, the Iraq of the 1950s, you had cosmopolitan, thriving, diverse religiously, racially, et cetera, ways of thinking politically. You had these diverse, thriving countries that were a lot like what we have in the Western countries. You know, their sort of lifestyle was much more tolerant and all of this. And you point out that there were three major events that tie themselves to more of the extremist religious element that happened in 1979 that brought about a lot of this sort of upheaval and chaos.
That's correct. And I really love that you noticed how I try in Black Wave to bring out the culture, the poetry, the music, the literature, the sciences, the math. I mean, the pages of Black Wave are full of that, because even today, even in the darkness that we're having to endure today, there is still so much creativity and so much diversity. But three events in 1979 changed the trajectory of the region and changed, as the title indicates, our collective memory and our understanding of our own culture and societies. And those three events are the Iran Revolution of 1979, the attack against the Holy Mosque in Mecca in November 79 in Saudi Arabia by Saudi zealots, and then the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. And those three combined provided for a really toxic brew, which set the region on a totally different path, which leads us to where we are today. Sectarian violence, rivalry between Iran and Saudi Arabia that is enduring, and the rise of extremism and intolerance. And it's the cultural intolerance that eventually leads to extremist violence.
And I don't want to oversimplify this in any way, but to sort of back it out and give it a 30,000-foot view, the majority of the destabilization that has happened, that's led to the sectarian violence, the rise of ISIS, the various different groups that are at each other's throats that are various extremist organizations, a lot of that is being fomented by two major powers and their own rivalry against each other because of the split difference that they have religiously, and that would be Saudi Arabia and Iran. Do I understand that correctly, that they are, for their own nationalistic and their own religious reasons, they are trying to fight over who is sort of the major player in that region, and in so doing, they're happy to foment and sometimes create chaos that allows them to sort of bring up their war machines and drive up that nationalism within their country, and it keeps everybody distracted from what the real goal ought to be.
Yeah, I think that's a very, very good summary. It's a battle for power. It's a battle for supremacy. Going back to one of those, you know, simplifications that American officials use about the region, they often say Sunnis and Shias, the two main sects in Islam, have always killed each other, and so it will always be like this. But actually, it's a recent modern phenomenon. I mean, the historical schism, the theological schism is there, but the sectarian violence that we see today between Sunnis and Shias was not the historical norm, not more than, you know, Catholics and Protestants killing each other throughout history. And so it's important to bring it back into context and to understand that Saudi Arabia, a Sunni power, and Iran, a Shia power, use religion for their own profane goals, and that is power. It's about power always, and that's what every country, every big country is after. I mean, that's what the United States is after as well, of course, you know, serving its interests, its position in the world. And so the U.S. is also a player in the Middle East, and it tips the balance in one direction or another. And unfortunately, very often, it has terrible unintended consequences, like after the 2003 war in Iraq, that opened up a Pandora's box that also contributed to where we are today. So in a way, I would say that unfortunately, U.S. actions often aggravate the situation.
I think a lot of people are looking at that, and you know, there's been a lot of presidents that have given lip service to trying to get us out of the Middle East, so to speak. I think in some ways President Trump has done more than others to try to do exactly that, but there's still mistakes that have been made. And I think if you look at, in particular, Syria, you know, you mentioned the 2003 Iraq war was in a lot of ways caused a lot of blowback. I think a lot of people would agree with you. And then you can sort of fast forward to Syria and another mistake that we made where we drew a red line and then we backed away from it and it allowed that squabble between those two power players to take over and increase the tensions in that region. And there's sort of, you know, it's like, I guess what I would like to ask you, because you've been a BBC reporter for a long time, you've written this book, you grew up in this region, this is your home region, and you have a great understanding of all of this. Is there a way that the United States can play a constructive role in sort of an exit strategy that gets, because I'm one that wants us out of a lot of people's business. I want a strong and powerful military that doesn't have to go anywhere very often. Is there a constructive way that we can come out of there without creating a power vacuum and help sort of return this to what it was before sort of 1979?
You know, Leland, it's very hard for the United States to totally withdraw from anywhere without consequences. And at the end of the day, America is a superpower, and you cannot be a superpower and pick and choose where you're involved and where you're not involved. you can decide that you don't want to be a superpower anymore, and you bring everyone home and, you know, close the doors and become an insular country. But that has consequences for America's standing in the world. I mean, that's what we're actually seeing happening in the Middle East now. When President Obama decided he did not want to go, he did not want to get more involved in Syria, no one was calling for a full-on intervention the way it happened in Iraq, but something that was more forceful than what the U.S. was doing at the time. When the U.S. doesn't do that, it does create a power vacuum that other countries like Iran and Russia exploit to their own advantage to try to become the masters of the region. So there's no magic formula, but I would advise, if I were to have that ability, or if I were an American, I would advise American officials to look at the Middle East through a different prism. First of all, of course, I would selfishly say, read my book. But I would also
And by the way, we're talking to Kim Gottes. She is the author of an incredible book, The Black Wave, and I think people should go out and get it right away. Didn't mean to interrupt you, but just to let people know that that's the book you're talking about. Yeah.
I would say two things. I would say American officials, American presidents have always looked at the Middle East and looked for a way to assert stability. And I think that's actually a terrible choice. It may sound like a wise choice, but stability has often meant backing up dictators in the region, whether it's Hosni Mubarak in Egypt, whether it's,
Assad in Syria,
Hassisi today in Egypt as well, whether it's being so close to Saudi Arabia, Saudi Arabia's ruling monarchy. Stability breeds oppression. Mm-hmm. Oppression breeds intolerance, and intolerance breeds violence. And that's why you see these outbursts of upheaval now in the region since 2011 with the Arab uprisings and today with the protests in Iraq and Iran and Lebanon. The second thing I would say is to always focus on the people. And I think that's hard to do when you're big power with your own interests. It's not just about serving other people. It's about serving your people. But I do really think that if you look at the needs of the people in the region and you press on these governments to serve the people's interests, it would go a long way to providing that stability that is sought after by everyone, not just in the region, but also the United States. And I know it sounds like idealistic talk, but I don't think it's impossible. I think it just requires long-term planning for every administration and not being bound by these four-year calendars that are determined by presidential cycles.
Yeah. Well, and I think, too, we have a tendency, because we do want that stability, because we think that is the key to the safety. So then we just generalize everything, and we say, going back to what I said at the beginning, oh, well, they just kill each other all the time, so we have to enforce the stability because it keeps us safer, as opposed to...
Yeah, but that's a cop-out, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a cop-out to say, oh, it's always going to be like that. There's nothing we can do about it.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think, and again, it's the wrong kind of thinking, and what you're saying is, let's invert that paradigm. Let's look at it from this other direction. All right, I know you've got to go. Before I let you go, can you just quickly explain to people the difference between Sunni and Shia? I think that's what I've got there. The Iranians are Sunni, correct? Is that right?
The Iranians are dominantly Shia, but they have Sunni minority as well.
And then
the
Saudi Arabia
are dominantly Sunni, and they have a Shia minority.
Okay. And what is the main difference in
the Muslim world?
What I was going to ask?
Most of the Muslim world is Sunni.
Okay. Gotcha. And what is the main difference theologically? Because you see in Saudi Arabia, they're sort of loosening up on those human rights, allowing more like women to drive and do various things. And then on the other side, they're much more hardline along those lines. What's the main theological difference between the two?
You know, I would put this slightly differently. I think that how progressive you are in your values and how you understand life and the world and modern life really has nothing to do with whether you're Sunni or Shia. The differences between Saudi Arabia and Iran have to do with their application of that law and their very strict application. And so, you know, for example, the veil is mandatory in Iran. Music is banned. The mixing of sexes is banned. And in Saudi Arabia, they took it even further, because for the longest time, only until, you know, up until last year, women were not allowed to drive, whereas in Iran, they are allowed to drive.
Yeah.
So it's about the application of a very narrow understanding of what Islam should be. But that's not how most of my friends understand their religion. And I have Sunni and Shia friends in Lebanon, in Pakistan, in Egypt, everywhere. The theological difference is after the Prophet died in the 7th century, there was a dispute about who was the rightful heir to continue his mission. Was it his closest relative or was it his closest aide?
Right.
You know, if I were to simplify. And Shias believe it should have been his closest relative, but the majority went for the closest aide, and that's what happened. That's how the schism happened.
And the key thing to take away from this is that the majority of Muslims, whatever sect they belong to, are far more progressive in their values and far more open and tolerant than the mainstream media a lot of times will lead us to believe, because that's more inconvenient than just lumping everybody into one simple thing. So, and I think that's why people need to read your book. Kim, thank you so much. I know you've got to go. Appreciate you very much coming on the Disruption Zone today. Folks, get out, get this book. It's The Black Wave. You can get it at any bookstore and on Amazon. Kim, thanks for coming on.
Thanks a lot for having me. It's great.
Great. Talk to you later. I think the key to take away from this is that if you are counting on the media, whether right-wing or left-wing media, to sort of educate you on what is happening in the Middle East, don't. It's very complicated. And what I took away from her book was that there is sort of this, I guess, the 30,000-foot view. I would like us to have the strongest military in the world and almost never have to use it. I line up strongly with President Trump on this. And I agree with what President did in the Soleimani situation. I think he took out a very bad guy who was a terrorist, and he sent a message to Iran that shook them up. But on a broader issue in terms of the Middle East and what we should do there, I think it's important to understand the people. And it's easy for us to say, oh, they're all just violent extremists, and they're all been killing each other for years, and we should just, you know, nuke the whole area and turn it into glass, and then we'll all be safe. It's far more complicated than that, and that's a very simplistic view of the situation. Yes, we should punch the bullies in the mouth. Yes, we should destroy any terrorist group that attempts to attack the United States. But beyond that, we have to remember that the vast majority of people in the Middle East are not like ISIS. They are not like these terrorist groups, Al-Qaeda and whatever. They are normal people. And up until 1979, that region was thriving very much like Western countries were. It was like an extension of Europe or even the United States. You could go to 1965 Iran and find kids at, you know, dance parties and people dressing the same way we did in the 1960s here in America and doing all those things and buying records at music shops and all that. All of that is oppressed now because of a single regime that doesn't represent the majority of the people in that area. And this is why I've been saying, you know, President Obama during his administration completely turned his back on Iran when they were about to have a revolution. Those same students rising up to get a Western-style democracy. They're educated. They want capitalism. They want economic freedom. They want personal, religious, and identity and individual freedom. They want those things. The vast majority of Iranians want those things. They don't want what the Ayatollah has foisted upon them. And I would imagine there's probably a large level of sentiment like that in Saudi Arabia as well. So anyway, you don't have to agree with everything that Kim Gott has said. What you have to do is understand that the situation is complicated, that the people are very real, and that the majority of people are not like the mainstream media would have us to believe, because the mainstream media profits in us hating each other and profits in us being at each other's throats. So anyway, I've felt like that was a significant conversation. Love your thoughts on it. You know, shoot me a Twitter at Twitter. I'm at Leland Show. Also at Zone Disruption on Twitter. You can also hit us up on Facebook, Leland Conway and The Disruption Zone on Facebook. And then, of course, we're on Instagram at Greatly Londo and at The Disruption Zone as well. So thanks for listening. We got much more coming your way. Also on the radar, the next installment of the DC Swamp Monster with Congressman Thomas Massie. He'll join us. So keep it tuned to The Disruption Zone. I'll be posting when those episodes drop. Thanks for listening. I'm Leland Conway. Cameron Mills, also our executive producer.